Hi, I'm Joe Lidster, and you're listening to the Handsome Timmy D Express.
Well, hello, dear reader, and hello, dear listener, and welcome to episode 11 of the Handsome Timmy D Express, which is a proud part of the Dan and Travis Show. That is the awesome podcast that you can find on iTunes and or the links below. And we're also part of the Chronic Rift, a series of podcasts that attempt to find the culture in pop culture over at the Chronic Rift, over at www.chronicrift.com. It is about time. You know, I started this whole blog podcast venture to really dive into the world of creativity and talk a lot about the world of screenwriting. And not since Joseph Lidster was on about a month ago, I haven't had a chance to talk to any of the writers. So finally, got myself a proper produced screenwriter. An old friend and colleague of mine has kindly taken the time to join the Handsome Timmy D Express. Stephen J. Lawrence, welcome.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Outstanding. Oh,
I have a quick question for you, and I've been wanting to ask you.
Okay.
Now, you're from Jersey. Is Handsome Timmy D just like a name that your friends gave you when you were coming up? That sounds like a Jersey nickname.
No, that's part of the. That's from my old wrestling days.
Of course.
I'll be getting involved in a. I'll be blogging about this. I'm going to try to do my wrestling memoirs.
That'd be sweet, man.
On the blog here, because it's not enough to fill a book that anybody would buy, but it's pretty cool stories. And
cool,
back,
man.
Back when I was at school, I wasn't going to be a wrestler, but I was going to be a character like Bobby the Brain or Jimmy Hart.
You're going to be a heel?
You're going to be a heel manager.
Nice.
And they said, my trainers came to me and said, come up with a character name. And I went home and I took like a week to figure out. And I came up with like five or six complicated characters. And they came to me and I pitched them all and they were like, no. No, none of those suck. Those are terrible. And I thought they were great. They were really intricate and all kinds of things. And then I said, well, there was Handsome Harley Race and there was Handsome Jimmy Valiant. What about Handsome Timmy D? And they said, there you go. Perfect. And then when I left wrestling, everybody who says in the business, and this might be a good segue, is to stand out from the crowd. And I said, how about Handsome Timmy? I'll take that with me. I'll take the Handsome Timmy D with me. And it's worked tremendously people don't always remember Bill and Frank in the office, but they always remember Handsome Timmy D.
Handsome Timmy D.
In fact,
wrong.
I've been negotiating with some positions, and sure enough, I think I'm allowed to say a line producer called me today with the greeting, Handsome Timmy D, let's talk
business. That's awesome.
So it's worked out good. So, but you are standing out from the crowd yourself, my friend. Congratulations. You've recently sold and produced. Tell us all about this hopefully groundbreaking venture.
Well, it wasn't me selling it. I got hired. So yeah, like that was to me, it was even cooler because selling spec scripts is awesome, but it's nice to get hired to write something because that gives you automatic credit, you know, and you may lose your soul credit, but generally you'll get that soul credit. If they hired Handsome Timmy D to write it, Handsome Timmy D's name is going to be on the screen. Whereas they buy Handsome Timmy D's script, Stephen Lorenz might do the last little I won't say bull crap, but sometimes you change a tiny bit. And you get that writing credit.
Absolutely. You know? I mean, that literally is the crux of, like, countless WGA arbitrations.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Yep.
So
absolutely.
Many.
Absolutely. But, you know, my manager at the time, Dal Walton, M. Dal Walton, really good cat, and he was managing me at the time. He still helps me out now, but he's not really into management. He's more into trying to get back into production and directing. But he hooked me up with the guys over at Asylum who produced Sharknado that everyone loves.
and Sharknado 2, the second
and
one.
And Sharknado 2, that's right. And he introduced me to a guy over there named Micho. And Micho does a lot of the development stuff. This was November 2012. And I had literally had about three pages of ideas to pitch them stories on. And I mean three pages as in maybe three lines for each one.
Right.
I had science fiction ones. I had horror ones. And I had urban action because that's what they were looking for at the time.
Mm.
And then let me just interrupt really quick and say to anybody who's looking to write out there, you know, find out what a person you want to pitch, find out what they're looking for.
Yeah.
Because you go in with a brilliant concept for a psychological thriller and they're looking for a kid's rom-com, it can be brilliant, it can be groundbreaking, but they're not going to take it. And on the other side of that, just because one person doesn't like it doesn't mean it's shit. I mean, and this is obviously for the audience, Tim, you know all this stuff, but, you know, this industry is all about opinions. You know, people say it's all about politics, blah, blah, blah. That's a different story. I don't really get into that stuff, but it's all about opinions. You know, if I grew up watching Freddy Krueger and you give me a script for, say, the next Gone with the Wind, you know, it can be great, but I'll pass.
I'm going to kick you out of the office.
Exactly. Beat it. Kid, that sounds horrible. Gone with the Wind, that's a horrible idea. Beat it. Take it down the block, you know. So, but, and that doesn't mean, you know, the next maybe fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth guy will look at it and say, wow, this is brilliant. You know, let's do it, you know. So, I mean, but anyway, back to the story. So I went and met with Micho. I gave him all my ideas. He liked some of them, but they were in the middle of producing so much at the time that he's like, you know, I'll get back to you. And he stayed in touch with me. I never got the quote unquote Hollywood treatment from him. Mm-hmm. You know, and I never got pushed away, never got snowed. And but we had some in July, July 2013, last year, he calls up our manager, Micho, calls up our manager, and he says, hey, you know, we're doing this story called Art and Fury. You know, it's a World War II movie, and I'd like to use Steven to write it. And of course, I said, okay. You know, when I went into the office to meet with him again, he told me, he said, Steven, you know, I picked you for this. Actually, he told the director was there with us, and he said, you know, I picked Steven because when we were developing another idea, he was really good about changing things and changing it. Because I gave him an idea for a movie called Brothers. It was an action film, an urban action film. And he liked the idea, and so developed it a little bit, sent it to him. He sent it back, changed this. He did this for like a couple months back in November 2012. So by the time I got to, you know, shoot forward again to 2013 July, he's like, you know, you were so good at that, you're the kind of guy, you know, we want to have. So, yeah, you know, I wrote it. There's, of course, notes and more notes. And some of the notes canceled out the other notes. But honestly, as a writer, and I wouldn't mind if they heard this, you know, you eventually pick which notes sound the best to you.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not going to get in trouble. You know, if you're getting one note says add a love story, the other note says no love story, whichever one you like better. And if it does come back to you, be like, look, man, I heard this from here, I heard that from there. You know, I mean, as long as you can be held accountable, right? It's one of the biggest things about this I feel is changing about this town, about the industry, is that more and more people are accountable and are actually becoming a little more human. You know, it's not just guys staring at their BlackBerry while you audition anymore. Some, you know, it is some point, but, you know, there's a newer breed, and more people are coming up who are like, you know, let's bring this back to actually putting out some good product, you know. And it was nice to have that experience with Asylum. Because one of my big things is, you know, if you won't do it for free, don't do it for a living. You know, and these guys, they did not pay me much. And it was no secret. The guy told me that they weren't going to pay me much. And I really don't think they would mind if the rest of the world found out that they didn't pay me much. But it was a screen credit. I wanted to do it, you know, and it was what I was going to do anyway. You know, even if they hadn't paid me, I would still be sitting at home writing. So
I think you're hitting a lot of nails right on the head. You're I could almost just let you just talk for the rest of the hour. I'll be back in 40 minutes. Because I think you're right. Like, you talked about a couple of things here where it's like you're hired. You're a professional. So
yeah.
Guess what? Now listen, to a lot of aspiring screenwriters, it's hard. Nobody likes notes. No writer is like, oh, fuck, yeah, 5 pages of notes. Nobody's like that.
Sweet.
Yeah, but guess what? We're signing up for that, especially when you're hired, especially when you're a hired gun, especially when you're professional. Look, everybody knows you're brilliant. Every screenwriter is brilliant, yes, but we have to pick our battles.
You do.
And it's some people hear that and some people will look at what you just said, Stephen, and kind of consider it like, oh, well, he's sold out or he compromised his principles. But, well, yeah. No, but in order to work in show business, make a name for yourself, get a reputation as a professional.
Yeah.
You have to be a professional.
Listen, you know, my dad is a musician. He's actually a dean now, but he produced, he plays the piano, and he's a blues pianist. He played with Albert King. He produced a bunch of his stuff, produced some stuff with Steve Ray Vaughan. And he used to tell me, I remember back in the 90s, somebody was complaining about how I think Nirvana or somebody had sold out. And my father told me, he said, listen, man, once you sign a contract to get paid for what you're doing, guess what? You sold out.
Yeah, everybody's. I actually always hate that phrase.
Me too. And it's still 12 years old. You know, yeah. It's just, you know, if you're an 11-year-old kid who really has stars in their eyes, yes, you sell out the moment that, you know, the so-and-so agency. Now, there's a difference between that and being a hypocrite. You know, there are certain groups and things like that that I took issue with because they made such a big deal out of not, you know, being sponsored and stuff like that. And later on, they get sponsored. But, you know, even that, it's entertainment. But that, it's a good lesson to anybody aspiring, you know, watch what you're saying. You know, make sure you can stand behind what you're saying. I can say, you know, that, you know, I'll never do this for this company. Well, if that company is coming up to me and they got an idea that I really like, guess what? I'm going to go with that company. So, I mean, you know, you keep your mouth shut.
I don't know how to say this without sounding like a dick.
Don't worry.
Well, here's the thing. Like, when I got in the business, my attitudes changed toward that stuff so far so fast I got whiplash. Like, dude, my attitudes, it was like, oh my God, that's how it works. Dude. Oh, that's why that happened. Oh my God, because it's a fight. I always say to every writer, I always say, keep fighting the good fight. You know, I'm stealing that from way back. Well, I'm a World War II buff myself, so I'm stealing all that stuff. And I say that to every writer who's up or down, keep fighting the good fight, because it is a fight. Now, I don't mean fighting like against the producers and fighting against the executives and everything, but picking your battles and getting your stuff. And because here's the thing, there's no executive who wakes up in Hollywood and says, find me the most brilliant 22-year-old film student who's never written or directed anything, and I want to make sure his vision gets to the screen unadulterated. No one is saying that. You've got to prove to them, hey, look.
Sorry, dude, but that's so funny to me because that is exactly what I thought when I first moved out here. And I was sad. I was like 27, 28. And I thought, sure, someone would see the script I wrote and said, they would have a tear coming down there and say, oh my God, this is brilliant. It's like Seinfeld says, you know, I thought they were handing out agents. Agents were handing out comedy specials at the airport.
Yeah. And it's, and I'll tell you, it's weird because I had an experience many years ago where I gave a script to a very, I don't want to say powerful person, but let's say an established person who was a former agent. He was head of development at a company.
Okay.
And he pulled me into his office, and Steven, it was like he was Bill Belichick and I dropped the game-winning fumble at the Super Bowl. I mean, he didn't yell at me, but it was like, this script is terrible.
I know what you mean, man.
And you know something? I went home. I took it on the chin. I said, I said, anything good? He goes, the dialogue is great. I said, okay, cool. I can do that. And I went home, and when I took his notes and I sat down and read him, I was like, oh my God, he's right. And I have been such a much better writer since.
Yeah.
That type of thing. And I don't know if you've had a similar experience.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my God.
Do you not find that kind of separates, and I mean this non-gender specific, the men from the boys, the adults from the children, the pros from the fans?
Yeah. Well, like Jay-Z says, it separates the pros from the cons.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, there you go.
Time to separate the pros from the cons, the platinum from the bronze. So, yeah, but I mean, absolutely. I had, in fact, the guy who was managing me, who he's a producer, director, and I'm actually working on him with some stuff. You know, we work on stuff. We worked on quite a few things together, but when I first met him, he was one of the first people who had me working on a project. We were working on a script. It's not a big deal. And I'm sorry, it's not a big secret. We were working on a script about Dali. I mean, it was like 8,000 scripts about Dali. But
shit, there goes mine. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, buddy.
Yeah. Actually, I don't have one. Don't worry.
You're the only writer. You're the smart one.
I want to see yours. That's why. Loyalty, man. No, I want to see your version. But so, I'm sorry. You guys are making your for developing Dali.
Yes, yes. You know, he hired me to write that. But while we were working on that, we were working on other things together. And I would send him. We did a bunch of shorts, and I would send him the scripts for the shorts, and he would just tear them up. Like, that's not funny. He's like, I want satire. That's not satire. This isn't good. What does that mean? This is bullshit. And I'm like, oh my God, he doesn't recognize my genius. And then I looked at it, and then, you know, the great thing about it is that all of that stuff got me to the point where when I went to Asylum and I got that first round of notes, like you said, you know, your guy told you that, you know, the dialogue was great. to me, by that time, the dialogue was great, was the best compliment ever. If somebody established, told me the dialogue's great, I'm like, yes, I have succeeded as a screenwriter. Because to me, that's always the one thing that bugs me in movies is crap dialogue. Even from some of my favorite directors, I'm not going to drop any names, but I've seen some stuff from some directors where they're great directors, but sometimes the dialogue just dies. But it's not dead for the whole movie, but at certain points you're like, you can tell nobody, they didn't give a pass to anybody else. It was just that person was like, this is what's going on screen. But yeah, no, so he would rip my shit up, man. And like you said, it made me a great writer. I mean, I would prefer to do it more constructively, but you know, that doesn't mean that the person who's being mean isn't helping you out.
Yeah. Let me throw this one at you because over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to do a review of The Blacklist.
Okay.
Hey, they review us. I'm going to review them. But spoiler alert, it's not going to be that negative. It's going to talk about how you need to hear these notes because let me throw this one at you. I want to hear, hey, this stuff is weak, this plot is loose, or this shit is not adding up, or your dialogue needs another pass. I want to hear that from an agent, a manager, a producer, The Blacklist, a fellow writer. I don't want to hear from an audience.
Absolutely.
Because an audience isn't going to say that. An audience is going to say, that fucking sucks.
Yep.
What I mean? And there's no fixing that.
That's exactly what they're going to say. You know what? That brings you to a great point, actually. I hope I'm not cutting you off.
No.
Okay.
You're the guest, man.
Well, I was going to say that brings you to another point that we spoke about just before we came on the air, that as a writer, you know, I've given a lot of credit to screenwriters. And, you know, you don't always get to hear them on Handsome Timmy D or the other one that I used to watch that I actually loved was Jeff Berman, The Right Environment, WRT.
Yeah.
He would have Joss Whedon and those guys on. You know, Whedon's always outspoken about shit that didn't make it to the screen.
Yeah.
Which is awesome, you know, but you don't always get that. But I'm glad he puts it out there because a lot of people can realize that just because you wrote it doesn't mean that that's what's getting to the screen. And to use your analogy, or to use your example, there's no director who wakes up in the morning and says, no matter, you know, I want the perfect writer to collaborate with because I'm going to shoot exactly what he wrote.
Right. You know? Yeah, we're all looking for it. Or her.
Exactly.
Or her, we should say.
Yeah. And the producer gets up and, you know, and says, you know, this director's right. That writer's right. I don't even need to do my job. I'm just going to sit back in my fancy chair on set. You know, so I mean, just because, you know, a lot of people need to realize that, you know, if you want to be a filmmaker, be a filmmaker. If you want to be a writer, you're going to have to give up some control. That's just the way, especially like you said, if you're hired.
Yeah, if there's one lesson I've learned in the world of TV, it's pick your battles. I went through a note session recently. You know, we haven't sold it yet, but it's around town. And yeah. I don't think I'm breaking any contracts by saying the producer gave us a round of notes. And every round of note, he told us to change one of the lines in Act 3.
Wow.
And I never changed it. I never changed it once. And by the end, he even said, like, dude, I've given you this note like 8 times. And I'm like, I know. And you know something, dude? I really believe in that line. I really think that line is actually the crux of the story. And he says to me, you know something? You've never fought me on anything else. So guess what? You got this one. You know what I mean? Like, I worked with him on every other note. And here's the thing. A lot of his notes were good. It was really collaborative. And when you're able to create a collaborative process, it's no longer you versus them.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, he's now saying to me, yeah, you know something, you're right. I'll pull the notes. And that happened a couple times with him.
Dude, you're right. You know, the only thing I would change, and this is from my experience, is, you know, I would to the writers out there, I would suggest, because this is one of those don't try this at home things. Mm-hmm. It'll work for a Handsome Timmy D, especially if he's working with somebody. But if you're like unknown cat sending your stuff out and they give you notes, at least tell them. You know, you don't have to take the note, but tell them, you know, in the first pass, like, hey, man, I really believe in this line, you know, and then let them, because I actually ran into that with this, guys. I missed a note, and I legitimately missed it. Like, I'd seen it early and forgot about it when I was writing it, because I think it was right around the time my son was born. And it was a hilarious story that I'll get to in a quick second.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I missed a note and I sent it off, and Micho's like, you know, I don't know exactly what he said, but my manager said he was a little upset that I basically just kind of skipped his note.
Right.
And I was like, holy shit, I forgot about that note. You know, I didn't mean to piss in the guy's face. I just literally forgot about the note. So, I mean, if you're going to fight for it, do it at the beginning, man. Just say, hey, I believe in this note. And if they send it back and say, we don't like it, keep telling them. You know, yeah. at least open that dialogue so that they know you really believe in it. And by the third time around, if they're like, you know, either he goes or I go, you know, you lose your note if you want to get your movie made. But you might get that guy like you have who says, hey, man, you know what? You believe in it that much that you're willing to put everything on the line. Then you know what? We'll believe in it, too.
Yeah, and that's here's the other thing. I like the word you just used, which is dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, communicate. It's so easy to think of producers and executives as the enemy.
It is.
And I've got a few lined up coming up in the next few weeks to talk about that. Yeah. Because they're not. They want to make a good movie, too. There's always bad examples, of course, but
yeah,
many of them are actually out there and they want to make as good a movie as you do. And if the good response to a note is a dialogue and sort of like, well, hey, I have questions. Ask questions about like, well, ask questions, present alternatives, present why you believe in it, present why it fits into the rest of the story. So if you're going to just say no to a note or fight it, be armed and prepared.
Absolutely.
But don't say, hey, fuck you.
Yeah,
I'm not doing your fucking notes. Who's going to respond to that?
You're the fan, dude. I don't work for the fucking man.
Yeah.
Artists all around the fucking world, man. We're going to bring you down, Michael Bay.
Yeah. Or as opposed to, hey, you know something? It's part of the system and just...
And you know,
Be a pro.
Let me say really quick. I jokingly say we're going to bring you down, Michael Bay. I have no problem with anybody now who makes films that I don't necessarily care for, because I realized what you said, man. Everybody wants to make the movie that they wanted to see basically when they were 8 years old. So, I mean, you get a cat, and a lot of people give a lot of shit to Michael Bay. And, you know, I was one of those people before I got into the industry. You know, that's your job as a viewer, is to give shit to people who make movies. Some people are like, oh, well, I'd like to see you do a better job. No, that's not their job. They fucking slam, you know, parts together for machines, you know, 20 hours a day, 6 days a week, so they can pay money to see your movie.
Yeah,
don't ask them to do it. But, you know, and real fast, you know, I actually saw him, Michael Bay in particular, speak on something on YouTube I was watching, and I realized that whether I agree with that guy's vision or not, he so believes in the stuff that he's doing, man.
You can't knock him for that.
Got to give him credit, man. You have to give credit for that. Like, he's not a cat who wakes up in the morning and says, hey, if I use this coefficient times this times that, I'll make 50 gajillion dollars. You know, he's like, how to gets up like, oh, what if this explodes and that explodes and this explodes? He's a 12-year-old boy. You know, we all are.
The best defense I ever heard of Michael Bay, I'm not a huge fan of his Transformers movies, but what does he care? He's got $2 billion for it, and a lot of people are.
He's got $10 million.
So, if the kids today are going to see that version of the Transformers and really like it, go with God, enjoy, please. I have no bad wishes toward it. But another writer friend of mine said the best defense of Michael Bay is The Rock Criterion Collection. And I don't mean Dwayne Johnson.
I love Rock.
The Rock Criterion Collection and how he directed and how he managed that movie. And what he did to pull out the performances, he's like, that is the ultimate defense of Michael Bay. And hey, I have no argument.
You know, I can't completely deny Michael Bay for one reason. As a young black man in the 90s, Bad Boys was the shit, dude. I love that. I still love that movie. I didn't like the sequel.
See, there,
it's some Bad Boys, man.
There you go. And there's well, speaking of Bad Boys, we got to segue back to the funny story of your son being born, because you are actually a writer with kids.
Yes.
How are you pulling that? We have a cat. And that's not as high maintenance. In fact, I have to get up to check on her.
Yeah, right. You have to remember.
Tell us all about that.
Oh man, well I give you there's another reason why the asylum experience was so awesome, because Patricia had my son Malachi. He's 6 months old now. So this is back in. He was born on my birthday, actually, March
4th. Oh, wow.
Yeah, right?
Great birthday. Cool.
Yeah, very cool. So I got somebody to – when he hits, like, you know, 21, 22, you have birthday parties at the same bar.
You guys are going to be wasted.
Boom.
Oh, my gosh.
He can drive me home. No, son, you stay sober this year. But I know. But we – so she had him March 1st, and I didn't finish the screenplay. I didn't, like, get the last pass in until probably – mid to late April, because I remember I went to Chicago in May, and I was done at that point.
So you're telling us that it was quicker for your wife to create another human being for your significant other than to finish the script?
Actually, it literally was. She got pregnant in June. I started July 5th, and she had the baby about a month and a half before I finished that script. But I was actually sitting with him on my knee doing rewrites for that. And my my manager at that point, he could just feel it that I hadn't been sleeping much. And he's like, you know, they'd like for you to change this, this, and this, but not right away because you probably need a nap right now. Dude, it was, and I was just sitting there, and I have a daughter, you know, I have a 4-year-old daughter. And so, you know, it's daddy, I need this. And the little man's not taking no for an answer because, you know, at the time he's what, a month old. He was really cool though. He was very mellow, but, you know, it was definitely a great challenge because it was one of those things like, it's one of those things like having to write a comedy when you just got kicked out of your house and your car just got repossessed. You know, can you write comedy in that situation? That's your test.
I wrote a rom-com after a breakup once.
Hey, and, man,
it was, but I got to tell you, it was cool because I was like, well, if I could do this now, I can write anything.
Exactly. Dude, that's exactly my point. So, I mean, and those are the things that make you a more complete person, and they make you a more focused artist, man. You know, I have now, you know, we just worked it out 6 months later where I'll get a couple hours every day, you know, to sit down and write. Whereas before, you know, Patricia was really cool. She's like, hey, man, you know, 5 hours a day, go ahead, knock it out. I was like, yes, thank you. Yeah. Now you and I off the air, we're talking about, you know, having to write for 2-3 hours before you get to write. And that is a great way to do it, man. I don't have that luxury anymore. But you know what I can do, and I told you when we were scheduling the podcast, is that I can write at night.
Right.
Because once he sleeps in her room, and my daughter's old enough to sleep, you know, she knocks out pretty fast. You know, she sleeps like me. So I get a couple hours at night, you know, between 9 and 1 in the morning. I usually try to shut down around 11 to 12, but, you know, between 9 and 1 in the morning, I got as much time as I want to write, and I'll get a couple hours during the day. So, I mean, it really is, for me as a writer, and really as an artist in general, man, it's one of those things where if you really want to do it, you will get it done.
You will find the time. For me, that is actually probably my biggest challenge, is the time management and learning just how to write whenever and wherever you can, because that's the necessity. Until you are properly working, making a living where you could sit down with your accountant and say, I am a screenwriter. here's my residuals, and here's what I've gotten, and here's my payments from the studio. Until you can say that, you are going to have to find ways to write whenever and wherever you can. You know, Megan, I don't think it's a secret. We talked about she gets up at 5 in the morning and writes for 2 hours before going to a full-time corporate America job.
Yeah, that's what the girl on either your first or your second one,
that's my girl, Megan. Yeah. Oh, that's right.
Hey, was that your wife? No, your girlfriend.
That's my girlfriend. Hold on, no rush. Oh, wait, that's my significant. Yeah.
No way. Yeah, no, that was cool as hell. She okay. So she talks about it. Yeah.
I'm so jealous because she could sit down and just write. I need to
You'll get there.
You know what I do now, which helps me out. And this is the first thing I do. And this is not a trick I've seen a lot. Mm-hmm. I've seen it somewhere, some other places. Mm-hmm. I sit down and I rewrite what I wrote the day before. Start with the day before stuff. So if I write like pages 1 through 5 on Monday, when I sit down to Tuesday, the first thing I do in the first hour is read 1 through 5 and rewrite and pick along and fix as long as I go away.
Yes.
Whereas if I just try to start where I picked up, I'll be on Facebook for an hour. You know, I'll be fucking around on ESPN like, oh, I've got my fantasy. And, you know, you need to like – I almost like equate it with like sometimes with swimming. Sometimes you can dive in. Sometimes you need to go on the shallow end and swim around a bit. And I found that method works for me really, really well. Because, again, we all have to find that shit. Like, oh, you know, and the other thing I do, Steven, let's listen to this shit. This is as old school can be. And I tell other writers this all the time. And, you know, people take me up on it. And some people are like, really? And I'm like, just go to Ralph's, back to school, and buy like 10 of those spiral notebooks.
Yes.
And a pack of pens, and just carry it everywhere. You're waiting for a Jiffy Loop, just write down ideas, write down character names, write down everything. I've filled up like 5 or 6 in the past year. Now, a lot of that stuff's never going to see the light of day, kind of like your list of ideas that weren't all taken.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about that too, because you can't just have one. You've got to have a lot. I mean, you threw an armada at these guys.
Yeah, I think I actually counted as 40, 45.
And here's the thing, they still hired you, but you're 0-45.
Yeah, right.
I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean like that's just it's a great thing
because it gets your feet in the door. If they like your ideas and they like something about, you know, I heard somebody, I can't remember who it is, But there was someone famous once who said that this place is like a big playground. If and not a playground, but a sandbox. You know, if they like you, you can play in the sandbox.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, it really is about this. Not about kissing ass, but if you're a nice person and they just kind of dig you or like your vibe or how you write, you don't even have to be a good writer. And that's not very good advice for screenwriters. But to the honest business part of it is sometimes the best writer isn't the one who gets the job. It's the one that they like or the one who's willing to deal with notes the way they want them to deal with notes. And then these are business aspects. You know what I mean? It's not creative at all. You know, and these are people, if you got, you know, I like to talk about that stuff because one of my least favorite things is to hear people like famous writers and directors give their process. And it's the process. Like the example I use is Sorkin. I love Aaron Sorkin.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching an interview with him, and they asked him what his process was. He says, well, you know, I usually write the first draft, and then I just kind of, you know, grab Rob Reiner and those guys, and we work on the second draft together while they're shooting. I'm like, okay, that's great for Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah, I've tried that. He's not – Mr. Reiner's not emailing me back, though, Steve.
Bastard, can you believe it?
Yeah, I know.
So, but yeah, you know, there's the business side of it is, you know, you have to not only be good – but you have to be likable. You know, you don't have to be a swell guy, but you have to at least be willing to play ball on a production, you know, to get yourself out there. Unless you want to be a filmmaker. Like I said, if you're going to go out, some people just go out and get it done and make it. And I tried that. I'm going to be honest, man. I'm not a director. I directed two things and they were both horrible. Now the projects weren't bad. Just the experience for me was just, it's too much.
You weren't in your own skin.
Not at all. You have to do everything as a director. You have to stay on top of the editors. You have to stay on top of the caterer or call the food in if you're doing an independent thing. You have to do PA stuff if you don't have any PAs. You have to stay on top of the director of photography. Everybody. You have to watch everybody. And you have to do everybody's job for them or help them do their job. And then after it gets shot, you're like, sweet, it's in the can. That's just the beginning.
Yeah.
You have to do all the post-production stuff. And I'm straight, man. I'll stick with and dealing with. And you have to be really nice to everybody. And I got to be honest, man. I've been on set, and when I wasn't directing, I'm like, man, I'm glad I'm not a director because I would have punched that dude in his fucking face. That's why I realized my strength is writing. It's not directing.
You know, I think that's absolutely a phenomenal point. And a good crew that's put together, a good executive producer in the world of TV or a good showrunner.
Yeah.
You know, we'll absolutely figure out, okay, these guys are going to be a good fit here. They're going to be a good fit there. They're going to be – and find people and their strengths and everything. Because it's funny. Like, I remember one time talking to a production manager, again, somebody I'm hoping to line up soon for the podcast, where they said to me, God, I don't know how you deal with all that creative stuff. Literally said that. It's like, I don't know how you deal with all that stuff all day. I don't know how you come up with ideas and do this and do that. And I'm like – I don't know how you get on the phone and deal with locations and shit all day. That sounds nuts to me.
And then
it was like, well, we got along great because, hey, you're doing your thing, I'm doing my thing, and we're all helping each other.
Absolutely, man. You know, and it's nice to meet somebody like that. And it really reminds you, it helps you to realize that kind of thing and being hired for something. It helps you to realize that what you do is worth being paid for. You know, when these guys hired me on, it kind of cemented that I was a professional, you know, a legit professional writer because I had something produced, which we talked about again off air. There are plenty of writers who have gotten rich and maybe have had 2-3 things produced.
Absolutely.
And
then,
you know, and sometimes studios will buy things just so somebody else can't shoot it. But they'll pay you $5 million for that script, but they're never going to shoot it. You know,
absolutely.
So you can literally get rich off of selling a couple scripts or a couple jobs. And those movies may never see the light of day. The good thing about working for Asylum is that the one thing I really knew going in was that those guys, they don't green light a project. They're not going to shoot. They
absolutely
have a, and this isn't a secret. I've actually seen them talk about it on a little thing they showed online for Sharknado. They have a specific formula. They're like, okay, how much can we make off this movie? Okay, that's how much you're going to spend on this movie. And if they spend the money on that movie, they're going to put out that movie.
Yeah, and what I love about their business model, too, is it's showing that the Hollywood production dollar is changing so fast.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and it's weird because here I am in 2014, and the features I'm writing and developing for producers right now are so low budget, Steve, and it's not even funny.
Hey, man.
It's literally thinking about, like, okay, what can we – can tell you what, you know, I've got people saying to me, just to speak generally, I can get $2 million. Can you write me something we could shoot for $2 million?
Dude, yeah, that's the name
that's
going to
be smart and compelling and dynamic that actors will want to take part in, and that we can shoot for two and make six.
Yep,
that world is not only alive; it's starting to really thrive again.
It is, and I'm glad
VOD
you said
and everything.
Absolutely. Oh, no. Go ahead.
I was actually just going to remind the reader. Steven and I have not talked in a long time, so we're kind of excited to be sitting here chatting.
Yeah.
So sorry. We're like a couple, a couple of kids wrestling in the playground here.
Right. what I wanted to say. Oh, and by the way, speaking of wrestling. Didn't you body slam somebody when we worked together last time?
Oh, well, I didn't do a body slam, no, because he wouldn't go up for me, damn it.
He was so cool. What was it? It was
oh, no, dead? I showed Hudson how to collar and elbow tie up.
Yeah,
showed,
that's what it was.
We did a couple of go-arounds, go-betweens, and I put the post supervisor in the sharpshooter.
That's what it was.
And showed them how much that really hurt.
He didn't think
it would hurt, so I put it in, and I knew how to do it in a way where he's like, that doesn't hurt. And then I sat back. He's like, oh, shit. He's okay, though. He's okay. Don't try this at home, kids. I was trained. K-fabe. I'm a professional.
K-fabe.
I was trained.
K-fabe.
I know how to do it.
I just like to yell out kayfabe now.
I don't know what that means. I've never heard that phrase.
But that was funny. But what I was going to say is I'm glad you brought up the point about I completely forgot what you
were talking about. VOD and just small budget.
Right.
Stuff, you know? They're taking over.
Yeah, what I was going to say, totally forgot. What I was going to say is that, I started out in college writing plays.
Mm.
And when you write a play, then I write movies the same way I write plays. Because when you write a play, you want to get it produced. It doesn't matter how big you are. If nobody's going to produce it, that play's not going to get made. The only way it's going to get produced is if it doesn't cost that much, which forces you to rely on actual story, actual dialogue, actual drama / comedy / whatever, all these old school things that a lot of people don't think you need to rely on because you have the magic of CGI. Well, unless you're making that movie yourself, cut the explosions.
Yeah.
You know, add them later. Once you get that $15 million budget, then you can go in and write the shit out of it. You know, but in the meantime, you write that basic, as few set changes as possible, as little large scene pieces as possible, scene pieces as possible, as few characters as possible, and you just make it happen. You know, that's the way, that is the only thing I can think of is like, as far as a formula that I ever have, I write it like a play, man. You know, and coming from Chicago, it's a big, you know, big play city. So, I mean,
David Mamet, end of story.
Exactly. Yeah, right? So, but you write and you write it. And, you know, that was why I was a big fan of his. I'm not even getting his personal life, but I love his movies. I love his plays, and I love Glengarry Glen Ross. I think he did The Heist. I think he wrote The Heist. And I love The Heist because they're simple. You know, and The Heist didn't have – yeah, it took – part of it took place in an airplane, but there was nobody hanging off the wheel trying to shoot at a guard.
Dude,
you know what I mean? Like it took place in a damn, in a little terminal, you know?
American Buffalo is about two guys planning a theft, and they never do the theft.
Exactly. Glengarry Glen Ross has like two set pieces.
I wrote a paper on that, and it made me want to make me go to film school. I mean, Glengarry Glen Ross, I'm still in awe. And here's the thing, though, too, and this is a trick. Hollywood doesn't know and understand writing yet. Like a lot of producing executives are creative, but they don't know how to write a screenplay. They'll tell you that, you know, that's why they need us.
Absolutely.
But they know how to write, three helicopters shoot down the spaceship. Okay, that's what it's going to look like in the script. Okay? We all know that. However, if you can write a – let's just say you write, you know, I don't even want to give one away, but – well, this is actually a script that I own. Let's say how about a low-budget feature or a low-budget – or a play about a mailman who falls in love with a war widow up the street.
Yeah.
Those two people interacting every day, and can they and can you make that compelling and interesting? That is why Hollywood hires us. And you know something? Even if you write that low budget thing, you still may get called one day to write Guardians of the Galaxy or one of the Star Wars or the Lord of the Rings because it's like, well, hey, those stories are still driven by character. We know how to do the explosions, we know how to write the Millennium Falcon blows up the Death Star or whatever.
Exactly, yeah.
But we need to know why Luke Skywalker is lonely and wants to save his father.
We need to know why Star-Lord is doing all this crazy shit.
Yeah,
Exactly. By the way, I just saw that last Saturday.
Isn't it awesome?
Love Chris Pratt, and I love that movie. And, dude, the thing that blew my mind was I saw David Batista. I'm like, is this Batista?
He's so good. Amazing. Oh, my God, it's Batista. He's amazing. He broke out. He broke out.
I couldn't believe it. I'm like, oh, my God, that guy was so good. Nothing goes over my head. Like, he was so good with deadpan. And
underplayed.
He's just good.
And that's the thing. When you saw his machine gun entrance in the WWE, you wouldn't think he could underplay that.
Exactly. But the same with The Rock. When you saw The Rock jump up on the turnbuckle, you know, you wouldn't expect him to do that really great role in, was it Get Shorty sequel? He was only plays the gay actor. He's hilarious.
Be cool.
Stay cool. Stay cool. Yeah. Be cool. Yeah, he was hilarious in that. And like that, you know, that's why he gets some decent roles. Like, you know, the Rock may or may not win an Oscar, but he can pull it off. He's like a Samuel L. Jackson. He makes you want to go see him.
I hope he does. I think I don't know if he could pull off an Oscar, but I think with the right role, the right material, maybe as he gets older, you know, he might need to hit the big 5-0.
Yeah. About 5-10 years, he's going to be polished, man.
Because I could see like a 55-year-old Rock as – I'm probably going to get a lot of shit for this, but I could totally see a 55-year-old Rock in like The Fugitive. In a Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, for sure.
He would know how to pull off that silent menace. Because he did that when he was in the Nation of Domination WWE. He knew how to do some of that really small domination stuff. So we're pulling for you, Dwayne Johnson, if you're listening. And if The Rock is listening, he's got an open invitation to be on the show anytime.
Hey, but of course. Who would ever turn The Rock down for it? He's like I never even met the dude, but all I ever hear about him is he's basically the black, muscular Tom Hanks.
I've never heard
that. He's like the nicest dude ever.
Yeah, I've never heard a bad thing about him. As a pro, really haven't. But I got to tell you a funny Guardians of the Galaxy story, though. I suckered Megan into going to it, right? So I was like, everybody's talking about this. We have to get. She doesn't watch. She likes the comic book movies. Like, she likes some Iron Man, Avengers, but she knows nothing about this stuff, right? Yeah, so we get to the movie theater. We're sitting there, and you know, all the rigmarole is on the screen and everything. And I said, you know, the main character is a raccoon. And she goes, what? She goes, no, stop it. You're fucking with me. I said, no, it's a raccoon. And she's like, what do we do? No, I'm not watching a movie with a raccoon. And I said, no, I'm telling you. I said, well, Bradley Cooper's the voice. And she's like, now I know you're kidding. She's just not tuned in. And we watched it. And like, sure enough, Rocket Raccoon comes up. And she gives me that look. And then we leave the theater. She's like, oh my God, that was awesome. That was so great. She loved it. So
it just was, man.
It worked.
Too many quotable moments, like too many just great moments in that movie. I can't even think of any, but Rocket Raccoon was awesome. Oh, Batista was awesome. Chris Pratt is always awesome to me. You guys are genius.
Zoe Saldana. Zoe Saldana. A superstar. Really a superstar.
Looked great, did a great job. Like, everybody was just awesome in that movie, man.
And really close to the Star Wars formula, the New Hope formula.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people have tried to recapture, but these guys actually did it.
Great job. And you know what's a really big thing for me was that they skip past the love interest. You know what I mean? Like, they
cut
out a close moment, and then it gets broken up, and she puts a knife to his throat. And then at the end of it, they're just kind of like brother-sister, you know? Because, I mean, they're on the same team. They're not going to sleep together. So it's kind of cool that, like, they didn't, it wasn't a big kiss with the two of them after they realized everything was okay.
Because I think, you know, the brother-sister point is almost more important, I think.
It is, absolutely. Yeah. For him and for her. It's for her to feel human with an idiot like that, and who's not actually an idiot, but the fool. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Her brother is the fool, and this is the person that she loves, even though he's the fool. And for him, it teaches him to have respect and actually have one woman in his life he's not going to sleep with.
absolutely right.
So, someone he can respect, you know? So, and that goes back to character stuff, man. That's what you call arc. You know, I'd love to talk about, like, just really, really quickly, man, when it comes to comedy especially, it lacks when it comes to arc. I watched The Office. I wasn't that into The Office, but I love Parks and Rec. And the characters on Parks and Rec arc. You know, like, they really have changed from season one to this latest season that just wrapped into the new season that's about to start up. The characters have all changed. And they get married and, you know, they have children. They do this. And it's still comedy. You know, it's not a drama. It's not dramatic. It's not a dramatic arc. It's still comedic, but the characters actually breathe. You know, they got one note for a few episodes, then two notes, then three notes, then four notes, and it just keeps building. Now, I don't know if you watch the show, but check it out on Netflix if you haven't. But that's the kind of stuff that I like to see, you know, on television, especially as far as comedy. It's something that goes beyond, you know, oop, that guy just farted. Now, yeah. I like the Three Stooges, and I love American Pie, but I also like to see a little bit, you know, I like Death at a Funeral. You know, and I like I never saw Gosford Park, but I like I can't think of any other high, like, well, quote unquote highbrow examples. But there's a lot of, I just like comedy, things that are actually funny without making people feel bad for not getting it. I mean, there's certain movies and comedians, I won't name anybody, but they make you feel bad if you don't get their jokes. I'm like, comedy's something that you should get. You know what I mean?
Have you seen Downton Abbey?
I have not, but I heard it's not that funny.
No, it's not, but check it out. Check it out. The reason why I bring that up, it's not that it's, well, sometimes it's funny. Maggie Smith is very funny.
Yeah.
Watch Gosford Park before you see Downton Abbey.
Okay.
Because I watched Downton Abbey and then watched Gosford Park, and Gosford Park is an accidental pilot of Downton Abbey. Yeah, it's very much, when you watch it, you're like, oh my God, this is totally this. And it's Julian Fellowes, it's the same writer and everything, and, and all that. And, So I would highly recommend watching them in that order, because it kind of, Downton Abbey kind of, not spoiled it, but I, unfortunately, when I watched Gosford Park, I was like, oh, I've kind of seen all this before, kind of thing. I think the comedy deal is an interesting stuff, because it's like, we had a really golden age there of sitcom for a while, you know, with the Levitans, with, Tina Fey. We're watching now, and we've been talking a lot about women in comedy and women writers and the challenges they're facing, and I keep forgetting to bring up Julie Louis-Dreyfus and Veep, which is so freaking amazing, and everything. And I think we're seeing that, you know, kind
of
like you're saying,
Christine. New Adventures of Old Christine was a great show, and like my two favorite comedies is just the one's about to end, the other one ended, 30 Rock and Parks and Rec, both driven by women.
Absolutely, and it's there. And speaking of diversity, I think we're running long on a lot of stuff, but let's get into this. You are my first black guest.
Yes.
Welcome.
Breaking it cherry, as they say in Goodfellas.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk a little bit about diversity in Hollywood and things like that, because the women in Hollywood is obviously a very big touchstone or talking point right now. It's on everybody's mind. Deadline created that very, very strange controversy a few weeks ago by saying no women Ghostbusters, and of course Bill Murray just a few days ago came out and said, let's do it. And he said he loved to have women Ghostbusters. He loved it. I just wanted to share some of your thoughts about that world, and also what are the challenges that you think are facing black people in Hollywood? Because even though there is, I think, a really strong black presence, a lot of black marketing and production, I really hope I'm not sounding racist by saying this stuff. But,
unknown. There's no way to sound racist.
It's still, though, doesn't seem, there's still a, I think there's still a lot of, well, you know what it is for me? The demographics cross over a lot more than people realize.
Yes.
And I just wanted to get some of your thoughts about how represented, unrepresented, troubles, challenges, things that you've faced, or thoughts about all that.
Well, I go back to my two favorite comedies, man. I think 30 Rock and Parks and Rec are those kinds of shows that do a great job with that type of thing, because on 30 Rock, you have Tracy Morgan's character, Tracy Jordan, and then you have his guys and his wife, and you have the writer, Topher. Was it Topher? Yeah, Topher was the black writer. And they were very, very different people. And they even comment on it on the show. You know, they don't like each other because they're so different. And they do, in a really funny way, they really get to the point that blacks aren't either nerds or thugs. Like, there's a lot of between, like anybody else. And, and unfortunately, we're fortunately, we are out of the age where it's you have the black character on the teen show that says, "Hey, man, that's whack." You know what I mean? But we're not too far past it, though. And I mean, and then you get, you know, when you get, I'm going to say some names, but you know, I really don't mean any harm to anybody. I love Tarantino. I saw Django Unchained, and I did not like it. I liked the first hour and a half. But I felt like the least amount of time was given to his character, Django, and to his girlfriend's character. I mean, his wife's character. I didn't care about her at all. But, I mean, you watch it, and I feel like, you know, this is where you get to what are we allowed, quote unquote, to write. And the answer is whatever we want, of course. But, you know, Tarantino got a lot of shit about that movie, and I felt that it was unjust because a lot of people were mad at him about how he depicted slavery. And he said himself, and I agree with him, he's like, a lot of the shit that I put out there was like minuscule compared to what was actually happening during slavery. What I got upset about was that it portrayed, it made it look like every slave who got free secretly wanted to kill the person who enslaved them. And that really doesn't help, because it makes you as one note. It doesn't vindicate you. And there's no struggling, really. There's that kind of scene. I don't know if you saw the movie. Did you ever see the movie?
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, well, there's a kind of struggling scene in the beginning. I won't give anything away from you for you then, because it's actually, most of it was good. I shouldn't have said it. I only like part of it. I didn't know you could see it. I'm sorry. Watch it. You might like the whole thing.
It's a history of it. No, I actually want to watch the original first, which is why I haven't watched the his version.
Wait, the original?
Django. It's based on a Western, isn't it?
Oh, no. That was,
I thought it was a remake.
No. He did a movie called, that Western Django movie that was terrible. But it was an original piece. It was an original.
I was misinformed.
No, it was an original piece.
Oh, shit.
It's similar to an old movie that came out in the '70s from the blaxploitation era called Boss Nigger. It's a similar idea, but it's not the same thing. But anyway, back to diversity. I mean,
I've seen the trailer for that, but I have not seen that movie, which I will just refer to as that movie.
Or the Big B in.
Yeah.
But, I feel like as far as, blacks in America are a large part of the consumer base. And for a time, we were spending more money than anybody else. So like you said, of course, it spills over. There are black people watching Glee. There are black people watching, the Newsroom. There are black people going to the movies to see Guardians of the Galaxy. And, and you get some representation. I like Guardians of the Galaxy because there's one white guy and everybody else is some other color from some other planet.
Yeah, there you go.
And that's really cool. And, I love Stan Lee. Stan Lee talks about, doing Luke Cage, and he brings up a good point. I was watching a show on Netflix called, I forget what it's called, but it's about superheroes in a comic. It's about comic books. Lee Schreiber hosts it. And I can't remember the name, but basically he just wrote it, and he just wrote it. He didn't write it like a black person. He just wrote it. And my manager would tell me, don't try to write cool.
Yeah.
I would tell anybody out there who's not black or who is black, who wants to write a movie about black folks, don't write black. Just write a movie. That's what I mean. One of my biggest black screenwriters that I looked up to growing up was, filmmakers I looked up to growing up were the Hoodland Brothers. And they did House Party, they did Boomerang, and they did The Great White Hype. And those are movies that easily could have had a Mexican cast or a white cast. And you could have changed a couple little inside jokes, and it would have been the same thing. Can't Hardly Wait was basically an all-white remake of House Party.
Yeah, of Boomerang especially.
Yeah,
I could easily picture like Sandra Bullock and George Clooney in the same thing.
Absolutely, man. Like you hit it right on the head. If it were in the 90s, it would have been Sandra Bullock and either George Clooney or the British one.
Hugh Grant. Yeah.
Hugh Grant. It would have been one of those two. And you could have pulled it off because at the core, House Party is about a kid who wants to hang out with his friends, wants to do all these things, and his father's overbearing. And he's got bullies chasing him. These are things that don't just happen in black communities. Boomerang is about a guy who's a dog, and he comes up against a girl who's just as bad as he is. That's not something that just happens to black folks. Great White Hype is a little more ethnically segmented, but on purpose. And it's funny.
Right.
It's the white boxer versus the black boxer. That was the most underrated, and I thought it was really funny. But, those guys wrote movies that were just movies. They weren't black movies, quote unquote. And that's the thing that I've always, maintained with anything I wrote, was that it could be, because to me, I heard Keenan Ivory Wayans was being interviewed on a podcast I was listening to, and he was talking about back in the day when he was coming up with Larry David and Seinfeld and all them dudes, he had to be cross-cultural. There was no segmented comedy back then. There was no black comedy in 1981. I mean, it was Richard Pryor. You know what I mean? You put it out on records, but there was no large black comedy market in the early mid 80s. So your shit had to be observational, or it had to be, what is the deal with airplane food? You know what I mean? Like it had stuff that made everybody laugh, whether you were in Poughkeepsie or Harlem, and a lot of cats still do that kind of stuff. And that's why I applaud cats like Larry David. I love Curb Your Enthusiasm because he answered that question everybody had. I don't know whether he meant to or not, but everybody always wondered what it would be like if Seinfeld had black friends. And he answers that question on there because he has a black family stand with him, and they're a huge part of season 5 and 6, I think. But he has the black stand with him, and it's that, and there's no real. It doesn't depend on stereotypes. And
right.
You see a lot of that still in film and on TV. And you know, black writers and actors don't always help it. You know, I'm not a big fan of although I respect his hustle, I'm not a big fan of Tyler Perry. You know, I can't do the oh loudy loudy loud Jesus help me. Like that's not me, man. Like I grew up in that environment, but that's not the story that I want to tell. And again, Tyler Perry isn't in charge of telling my story.
Right, I like Tyler Perry because he's a big Star Trek nerd and wanted to Star Trek.
I won't take that away from him.
But not every white guy wants to write cowboy movies.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? I think that's. Yeah. I don't know if that's an accurate comparison, but
no. That's the thing, man. We're getting into a place where the racism is really subtle, but when you just peel back a layer, it's really obvious. You know, and it's you get into it with everything. You know, I don't want to stand on a soapbox, but you get to see it. I love Obama because I'm not saying I'm an Obama supporter. Before everybody starts calling me a whatever. I'm not really into politics, to be honest with you. But
well, I am a staunch Republican, Stephen, so we're going to have to wrap up tonight, obviously.
I know, but I love the fact that if you really sit back and look at it, he's been holding the mirror up to this nation for damn near 8 years now.
Yeah, there's like,
a lot of things they shit on him about that George Bush never got shitted on about.
Nor Clinton. It's absolutely ridiculous. And I don't know, I may be wrong about this. I feel like racism... Like, I got some friends of mine who hate political correctness, and they always bring up, like, well, how come this wasn't racist 10 years ago, but it's racist now? And I'm like, because racism changes. It's not one thing.
Right.
It's not just saying the N-word and wearing a white sheet.
Yeah, that ain't shit anymore. That's the least of my concerns right now is running into a Klansman.
There's 20 of them. But the problem is you have a guy, Ferguson.
Yeah,
is obviously and I've gotten into arguments with people who are and I wrote this on Facebook. My status update one day was, I don't know if I'm not sure this is about race. Said a bunch of white people hundreds of miles away. And here's the thing:
You're dead on.
And there's a lot about race I don't understand, and I'd really love to continue this conversation going forward and dig a little deeper because we're coming up on time.
Yeah.
I'm not going to sit here and tell you, I got a lot of black friends. I don't.
Yeah, that's correct.
I really don't. And there's a lot I don't understand, but I do know that when...
Just because you have a black friend doesn't make you not racist.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that might make you rationalize your racism more.
Exactly. That's exactly.
And here's the thing. If 100 white people go to Ferguson and say, this is not racist, and one black person says it is... I'm sorry, that one black person trumps the 100 white people, and vice versa. When somebody says, look, I am being persecuted for who I am, something I have no control over,
that is
what we have to talk about and address.
Yeah.
And to see this young man gunned down in the middle of the street and the lack of crime scene stuff is absolutely horrible. And anyway, I don't want to get – it's obviously something we're still –
Yeah.
You know, it's not in the national news, by the way, but like the other night, 30,000 people closed up the highway. The protests are still happening, and I think that's good because why the guy got arrested makes me crazy.
Yeah, yeah. No suspension, nothing. Like
you
shot somebody, regardless of what the circumstances. Generally, I thought when you shot somebody on a job, you got some time. There was an investigation usually to see what happened. I mean, you don't just take the cop's word for it. That's why they have fucking internal affairs.
And if the guy is innocent, if this police officer is innocent, he should welcome the investigation. That's the only way they're going to clear his name.
Absolutely.
So, hey, man. Strange,
Listen, I'll close it up really fast because I told you off the air. You know, the only thing that bugged me about it was that they didn't nobody came out and said, sorry, this guy fucked up.
Yeah.
Immediately it was, well, what did the guy who got shot who didn't have a gun do? What did he do? How come he got shot? Why did he get shot? Why was he doing something he shouldn't have done that got him shot? Like, no, it's not that simple.
And they kept looking for something.
Yeah, they really were. Yeah. Well, he just harassed the guy in the store. Well, obviously, he just harassed the store owner, punched him in the face a few times. Of course he deserves to get gunned down in the street.
Well, it's funny. I was in retail for 17 years, Stephen, and I can assure you we had a shoot-to-kill policy. Of shoplifters. We did not have a shoot-to-kill policy, for the record, dear reader. But I want to talk one last point, though, about the writing thing while it's on my mind. Jenji Cohen from the Austin Film Festival last year talked about this a lot. I'm sure she talked about interviews where I love her. Oh, God, and the show is amazing, and you have such a diverse cast, but she always talks about it's the character first. And I think that I want to back up your point, because I've written a lot of women, and the notes I get from women who have read – I've never had a woman tell me you can't write women. In fact, just the opposite. Yeah. But I will sometimes get a vocabulary note. You know, like, oh, she wouldn't say this. A woman would say this, you know, or something like that. Like, she wouldn't say stuff. She would say my things. Yeah, oh, okay. Right. And I think that's a good point for people. Like, and I'm about to write, we were talking about off air, but we hopefully won't get into detail about, I'm about to write a pretty racially charged thing. And I think it's a good reminder, because if I get, there are cultural differences.
Yeah.
There are dialogue differences. I don't think I've ever said I like Martin Scorsese's Hustle. You know what I mean? Yeah. But but that's the type of thing where...
Awesome, man.
Yeah, and I do, but I don't know if I'd say that. But I think that as a writer, it's important. Look, write your character. Write your motivations. Write your thing. Yeah. Because if somebody reads it and says, uh-oh, I don't buy this, that, as a cultural character, we can change that. That's fixable. You can do a pass on that. That shouldn't be coming first.
This is the thing. It's also actor stuff. You know, that's what my manager would say. Don't write cool. Like, that's something that the actor will bring to the set. You can write, hello, how are you doing? And if you get a black actor, you say, hey, man, what it is, or whatever the fuck he wants to say that sounds like they said in his old neighborhood. You know? So, I mean, that's not something that Tim needs to worry about. Tim's writing a great character.
Yeah.
If I make this character black, that black actor can take whatever side they want with that character.
And with every character, no matter what, I always tell myself this every scene, and it is always the answer. I talked about this with Joseph Litzer. What does every character want, and what is in their way?
Absolutely.
Even if you got a waiter with two lines, are they annoyed? Are they upset? Are they frustrated? Are they tired? Yeah. Are they blah, blah, blah? Because there's going to be an actor who's going to play that waiter or waitress.
Absolutely.
And he needs something to do, and that's important for the whole thing.
It's very important. I mean, I had Steve Kaplan's comedy class, and he always would say, you know, when your character gets what they want, they can leave.
Boom. Oh, I love that.
You know, once they get what they want, they're out of there. They don't have to sit around and chew up scenery. You know, I won't go into details, but he showed us some bad examples from TV episodes. But, you know, if I want a glass of water, as soon as I get the glass of water, nobody needs to see me go, that sure is a great glass of water.
Yeah.
Nobody gives a shit. Leave. You got your water.
Absolutely.
Beat it. That's my quote. You got your water. Beat it.
Absolutely. Well, we ran a little long, so we're going to beat it.
Oh, shit. I'm sorry.
No, dude. Are you kidding? Well, we definitely have to do number two when your silent movie comes out. And like I said, we're really having some great conversations about just diversity and equality. And I don't want to – not even on a soapbox. We kind of went off on Ferguson there. But I just mean in terms of just having a better understanding of – yeah, and I always say this like as a viewer.
Yeah,
I want to hear great stories, and I really don't. I don't sit there and go to the movie. And I back in the day, I'm sure some people did, but people don't go to the movies and say, you know, well, what do you want? Did the white guy write that? You know, nobody's doing that anymore. Yeah, just nobody's doing that anymore. So, anyways,
well, nowadays you can presume that it was. No, I'm kidding. I'm joking.
Well, unfortunately, the stats back that up, and hopefully, you know, there's a lot more that could be done for diversity, especially when it comes to women in town. And I think, again, it's like that thing of, you know, there's perception. Hollywood is a place of perceptions.
Yeah.
And we need to break a perception that when someone like you walks in the office, oh, I'm not doing a Tyler Perry show. No, this is the guy who's here to watch. He's going to write the World War One piece.
Right. Yeah.
Read it. It's great. You know, that type of thing.
There's a great story, actually, that I heard, and it's real short. Todd Bridges was talking about he was supposed to be in Emilio Estevez's role. I don't know if you ever knew this, for The Breakfast Club.
No.
And John Hughes really wanted him for it. And he met with John Hughes's writing partner, I believe. And he came in and the guy goes, I don't know how to write for black people. He's like, how do you write for a black person? And Todd Bridges said the same way you write for anybody else. And he got up and left.
Yeah.
So, you know, that hasn't changed too much. Like, a lot of people are so concerned about stepping on toes that they don't want to get anything wrong. And like you said, it's character first.
And you know what's stupid about that comment?
That
writer should have said, you know something? I'm not writing a lot of black people, so I may have some questions.
Yep, that's John Landis. That's John Landis. I watch Trading Places, and I watch coming to America, and he's got it down. And my manager would tell me, he'd say, hey, man, that's probably the dude who's on set who's saying, okay, I don't know how this goes, Eddie. Tell me how they would do this, Arsenio. Tell me how they would do that. You know what I mean? Like, and that's why John Landis gets these funny, funny black moments on In Trading Places. You know, it's cool to be no jive turkey this close to Thanksgiving. That shit's hilarious.
Well, yeah, and I met Herschel Weingrad, the writer of Trading Places. Oh, no. And I can assure you, he's not black.
He'll tell you.
I know, right? No, he's so not black.
His name might as well be Dante Jenkins.
Seriously, but that's the thing. Like, open up the dialogue, have the communication, because that's how we're going to figure it out and make those great movies and stuff. So,
you know what? For anybody who is a minority, who's black, Hispanic, whatever, you know, like I said earlier, man, don't segment it. Don't go the other way and make it just as racist as what you're complaining against. Don't segment your scripts. If you want to write something about your neighborhood or something that's specific to that race, absolutely go for it.
Sure.
But when you're writing a movie, you know, just don't put their race in there. You're doing a description, just put, hey, this person is this. This person is a female. This is a male. They're this age. They're that age. You know, if you're writing a specifically black movie, of course, you know. But if you're just writing a movie, you know, keep it open. Keep it open. Because even Art and Fury, the movie that I wrote, I was looking at stills from it, and one of the characters ended up being black. You know, right. I didn't write for a black character. I wrote for four guys and a woman, you know, a couple women. And one of them from the stills ended up being a black person. So, I mean, that's just how it goes. You know, and like with modeling, you know, fashion guys, they make one outfit and it fits one size. So if you don't fit that size, you don't get to wear that dress. And it's the same with film. If they have an actor who's committed to it and you wrote it so that it sounds like a 15-year-old black kid and they got, you know, a 20-year-old white guy or white woman to play it, you're screwed. Like, they're going to pass on your script. Well, okay, we're not doing this because he wrote this whole thing for somebody that we don't want to cast. We want this person attached to it, just their vehicle, and this guy just wrote it for somebody else.
And that goes back to the flexibility and being a pro. So
Yeah.
All right. Stephen J. Lawrence, well, we're definitely going to have to continue this soon.
For sure, man.
Thank you so much for taking the time out.
Oh, dude, thanks for having me on, man. And seriously, anytime, just let me know when you want to do part two. I'm down.
Yeah, this has been a real pleasure. So, all right, well, thank you in advance for part two. We'll keep everybody posted on that. I got, like, a lot of part twos coming up. So,
sequels, man. Sequel season.
Hopefully people are still liking and digging what we're doing. So until that, I'm going to keep doing it. I'm going to keep... Posting.
I love it. Let me say one quick thing that I love that you do this and that you have people on who are helpful from all different aspects. This is the only podcast that I've heard that has a novelist on and has a publicist on. And AJ, shout out to AJ. Love me some AJ.
Yeah.
And you're talking about having a producer on and you had me on. And it's nice to have that cross section of people with varying levels of quote unquote success. And varying levels of experience in varying parts of the entertainment industry. So it's just nice to hear that, man. We don't get that from TV or a lot of podcasts.
Well, that's a real compliment. I thank you very much. I'm glad. I'm hopeful. Because, well, the other thing, too, is, like, I've really delved into the screenwriting world over the past 2 years online. Yeah. And this is – you can get in a bubble.
Yeah.
And you sometimes need to remind yourself, hey, actually, instead of reading screenwriting magazines all weekend, go out to the barbecue and hear what people are talking about in their favorite movies.
Yeah, or read a novel.
And,
you know?
Yeah, and talk to other people on set and find out what the challenges are that your script may create one day.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to add some positive voices to the overall collective, if you will.
Yeah,
so
man.
I appreciate that super high compliment. So
absolutely, man. I love it. Sure.
I may use that as a bumper. So
do it. See, black guys like me.
Yeah. See, boom.
Boom. You're welcome.
And
Obama.
Hey, I even got Teamsters lined up coming up. So
no way.
Yeah, absolutely,
dude. That's
dude.
Awesome. That's awesome. Hey, when I sold liquor, I was my union, because Chicago's a union city. You can't do anything without being in the union. And we were in Teamster City, so I knew a lot of Teamsters because I sold booze, and those guys are all the truckers.
Nice.
Awesome dudes. I'm sure they'll be able to tell you some crazy stories.
We'll see. Well, I got the edit button ready for it anyway.
I was going to say, they might be like, we probably shouldn't air that one. That guy's still alive.
We'll see. I'm looking forward to it. So, all right,
me
my
too.
Man. Thank you very much. Easy. And thank you, everybody, for Stephen, don't hang up there. We'll do a little housekeeping.
Oh, okay, cool. For sure.
And then just
sure.
want to thank everybody for listening. And, hey, please keep retweeting. Please keep posting and stage 32ing or Pinteresting and whatever it is you kids are doing. Lots more exciting guests coming up between now and the end of the year. Thanks again so much. This is Tim Davis on the Handsome Timmy D Express.